Hello, I'm Bob Stewart. This is number 0111, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
There, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0111. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we have a return visit from author Dan Calla. He's one of my favorites. His new book is called The Far Side of the Sky. It's a historical novel set in World War II Shanghai that deals with that city's little-known, sizable Jewish community.
It's an amazing piece of history that's not very well known, and one of the few positive stories of the Holocaust and the whole Nazi history is that 20,000 German Jews were allowed to escape to Shanghai. Just before World War II, the Nazis reluctantly let them go, and most of them survived the war there. And I really wanted to build a story, a novel that told this piece of history.
Nancy Rossman is the author of First Love, Last Dance, the true story of her mother, who fell in love at 19, got engaged at 21, but married someone else, then went back to her true love at 75. How did the two stay in touch all those years?
When my mother broke up with Peter and ended up marrying my father, she ended up living in Ohio. But Peter and my mother both had contact with these same friends who would keep each of them informed about the other. And also, starting about the time when I was 8 years old, Peter would phone my mother every year on her birthday just to say hello and to wish her a happy birthday. And I know this is hard to imagine, but my father wasn't jealous, and in fact, he would tease my mother with things like, oh, it's 6 o'clock, I don't think Peter's going to call this year.
Steve Bartolotta is the executive producer of the faith-driven film King's Faith.
The story is of a kid, he's just gotten out of jail. He's in a gang, and he gets out, and the only book that they really give him to read in jail is the Bible. He reads the Bible, and he sort of decides he wants to turn his life around. You know, we see what happens to him. Some of his old gang starts coming around, and there's some points of epiphany in his life to decide whether or not he's going to continue with his faith and how he's going to carry out that faith.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0111, was Bob Stewart, who was the Sunday morning news anchor at 1340 WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, where the Stuff File program is heard Friday nights after the midnight news. And thank you very much, Bob, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the Stuff File news, shall we? The Texas prison system has abolished the time-honored tradition of offering those about to face execution a fancy final meal. State Senator John Whitmer says in a letter to state corrections officials, "Enough is enough. It is extremely inappropriate to give a person sentenced to death such a privilege. It's a privilege which the perpetrator did not provide to their victim." The letter was in response to the insane dinner request, but not eaten, by white supremacist Lawrence Brewer before he was put to death a few weeks ago for a notorious 1998 killing in which James Byrd Jr., a black man, was dragged behind a truck for several miles. Brewer requested an elaborate meal that included a triple meat bacon cheeseburger, a meat lover's pizza, a big bowl of okra with ketchup, a pound of barbecue, a half a loaf of bread, peanut butter fudge, a pint of ice cream, and 2 chicken fried steaks. Amazingly, when it arrived around 4 p.m. at Brewer's cell, he declined it all, telling prison officials he was not hungry. Brad Livingston, executive director of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, said that Whitmer's concerns were valid and the practice would halt immediately. From now on, prisoners about to be executed will be offered the same meal that all other prisoners get that day. Kind of makes sense, actually. I'm actually surprised I agree with Texas on this one, because as you know, the Lone Star State loves to use the death penalty. They're so busy, they don't need an electric chair, they need an electric couch. Moving right along, we'll bet the folks at the Volkswagen dealership in Apolda, Germany, are wishing they never met 77-year-old Marlies Schiller. Ms. Schiller was trying to take a new car out of the lot for a test drive when she accidentally put the car in reverse and slammed right through the showroom window and took out five other brand new cars in the process. Five of them. A police spokesman said, and I love this quote, "The coffee machine seems to be the only thing she missed." All said and done, about $200,000 in damages happened in that accident. Hopefully, the dealership has a really good insurance policy. Boy, that was literally a punch buggy, wasn't it? Elsewhere, looks like we finally found a politician fitting of the profession. In Varna, Bulgaria, a group of locals fed up with politics as usual have put up a real donkey as a candidate for mayor. No, I mean it, a real donkey. Marco the Ass is promising hard work, no kickbacks, and a defiant determination. Society for a New Bulgaria campaign director, Angel Diankov, is heading up the project and says, unlike the other mayoral candidates and politicians, Marco has a strong character, doesn't steal, doesn't lie, and gets the work done. Incumbent mayor Kirill Yordanov is not taking any of this too well and has refused to share a platform with his donkey rival, saying, "It's undignified." And taking advantage of a wide-open door, Diankov says he agrees. He says he's right. Just think how Marco would feel sharing a stage with such a political crook. It would be very undignified for any self-respecting donkey. Oh, I don't know. All I want to see are the televised debates on that one. That should be fun. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, another story that has politics as its origin. Some politicians have been called dummies. Some have been called boobs. You can call this one both. In another humorous protest of politics as usual, a busty department store mannequin is running for mayor of Reading, Ohio, a suburb of Cincinnati. Kenny Tussle, owner of KT's Barbecue, is urging voters to cast their ballot for the eatery's top heavy mascot named Barbie Q to succeed Mayor Beau Bemis in November's election. Now, the voluptuous mannequin first gained fame in 2009 when Reading government authorities tried to force Kenny to cover up the bikini-clad mannequin, but he fought City Hall and actually won, saying business soared 40% after he planted the prop outside his restaurant. No easy task in these tough times. Mr. Tussle says he's quite serious and swears that his girl is in it to win it. He told local reporters, "This is not a stunt. We are asking for write-in votes. She's running on a real platform with real issues." And that is, when you think about it, really, really sad. Anyway, on to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. As I've said on this show several times, one of my favorite authors is Dan Calla. He has written several medical thrillers. As a matter of fact, he's also an ER doctor in Vancouver. But his last two books have been a bit of a departure. First, there was the sweeping hospital saga in Of Flesh and Blood. Now Dan has branched out into his first historical novel. It's called The Far Side of the Sky. And Daniel joins us on the line via Skype-to-Skype communications from British Columbia. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, Peter. Great to chat with you again.
Nice to talk with you again, too. So tell us about this new book, The Far Side of the Sky, and why you've gone into the historical novel genre.
Well, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago, when my first novel, Pandemic, came out, it was getting a fair bit of attention because it was so topical. Someone from Reader's Digest interviewed me, a lovely woman, but she looked as Jewish as gold in my ear. And at the end of our interview, we were just chatting, and she said, "You know, my parents, grew up in Shanghai." And I said, "What?" And she said, "Yeah, you didn't know about the Shanghai Jews?" And I had no idea. I had no idea about the history of Shanghai, but piqued my curiosity, and I went and started to research, and I was just blown away. I think Shanghai is the most amazing city in the 20th century, but particularly around World War II, because it was a microcosm of the entire world at war. It had everybody: communists, fascists, Chinese, Japanese, Germans, Jews, British, Americans, everything were there. And then I found out this amazing piece of history that's not very well known. And one of the few positive stories of the Holocaust and the whole Nazi history is that 20,000 German Jews were allowed to escape to Shanghai just before World War II. The Nazis reluctantly let them go, and most of them survived the war there. And I really wanted to build a story, a novel that told this piece of history.
So what is the story in The Far Side of the Sky?
Well, it's about a very secular German Jew who's a surgeon. He's Austrian. He's in Vienna, and he doesn't even really think of himself as Jewish. But when the Anschluss, when the annex happens, and Austria becomes a Nazi country too, or part of a Nazi country, I should say, he is immediately overnight becomes a pariah. And the novel starts on Kristallnacht when his brother has been lynched, and he's protecting his sister-in-law and his disabled daughter. He's already widowed himself. And he's desperate to find an escape. And there's these whispers in the community about Shanghai. So the first part of the novel talks about their escape from Vienna to get to Shanghai. And then when they land there, you know, they're a fish out of water. They're landing in this very exotic land. And then it becomes a survival story, but also a romance, because he meets a Eurasian nurse who's a local woman there. And they both volunteer at the local Jewish refugee hospital. And there's a bit of a love story and romance, but also a suspense novel and a war yarn, because the Nazis never forget about these German Jews who got away and still from across two continents try to get to them at some point. So, you know, the novel tells the story of the Adler family and them adapting to life in Shanghai and their trials and tribulations of in a larger sense, of all the people in Shanghai during World War II. I tried to give a little segment of what it was like to live through that time.
Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, you started out writing medical thrillers. And by the way, the first five books you wrote, all excellent. Pandemic, Resistance, Rage Therapy, Blood Lies, and also Cold Plague. And then, as I mentioned, you went off that path as a matter of fact, I wasn't going to say, since you brought up a water analogy, I wasn't going to say deep end. You sort of dipped your toes into the water with the Sweeping Hospital saga. Is that sort of the first step to what you're doing now with The Far Side of the Sky?
Absolutely. You're totally right. Because as you know, you read it and you know there's a big historical section in the Flesh and Blood that tells the history of the founding of that hospital. And I so enjoyed writing, you know, a kind of period historical piece that had some relevance to today. And that really whet my appetite and gave me some confidence that I could write a historical novel.
What is it about writing a historical novel that you enjoy so much?
Well, in this, you know, in this particular case, there's such natural suspense and drama built in. As I said, this community had it all. So it's so ripe for drama. But also, you know, try to imagine yourself, to try to imagine your sensibilities, which weren't that different from, you know, very secular assimilated Jews in the 1940s and what they had to deal with, you know, when overnight, as I said, they became pariahs and persecuted. And then to go to this very exotic land and my wife and I went to China 2 years ago to research it, and I felt like a fish out of water. So I can't imagine what it would have been like to have been forced to relocate there. So I just thought the setting was so ripe for fiction.
Well, what is it like researching a book in a foreign land when the period you're writing about is historical? I mean, I'm sure that the Shanghai of today doesn't necessarily resemble the Shanghai that you write about.
No, that's a good point. But in a way, I was luckier because, you know, the Shanghai, this amazing multicultural city that was built by the British and the French largely. I mean, it was never really a Chinese city until after the communist revolution. But when Mao came in, he tried to, through the Cultural Revolution, they wanted to erase every trace of their history, certainly their colonial history. So there would, you know, but fortunately, they neglected the beautiful architecture rather than knocked it down and destroyed it. So after, in the last 20 years with the reforms in China, they've been rediscovering their history. So by the time I went there in 2 years, the beautiful Bund, which was the most famous street in Asia, with all those gorgeous Art Deco Gothic buildings from the 1920s and 30s are still standing. So you can go see so much of the history that I probably wouldn't have been able to see 20 years ago. I mean, I doubt I would have been allowed in 20 or 25 years ago to see it. But a lot of it still stands. So it's a good question, but you can get a sense of the history, and much of it is restored back to how it would have been back then.
And are there still a number of Jews living in Shanghai?
No, but they're starting to come back. There's an Israeli guy who sort of dedicated a service to just telling the history of the Jews. So they have this Jewish tour of Shanghai, because there was at one point six synagogues in the city and two Jewish schools and two hospitals. And it had this incredible culture. But everybody after 1949, all foreigners had to leave. You know, they couldn't stay when the communists first came in. But they're starting to reclaim some of this history. And the Chinese are starting to be proud of this role they played in protecting the Jews at the time.
Now, you mentioned your surprise when you heard of this story firsthand from someone whose family lived that situation. Now that you've written this book, and of course you're doing a media tour, are people surprised when they hear about this story?
Absolutely. Two things happen. One, it's amazing, particularly with Jewish people, because, you know, they're more attuned to the history of the Holocaust and such, or you know, it's more part of their upbringing. But so many of them still don't have a clue about this. But the other thing that happens is you start telling a few people this story, inevitably they know somebody who grew up, you know, primarily non-Asian, who grew up in Shanghai. And it's amazing that because most of the people after they had to leave from 1945 to 1949 ended up in Canada or the US or Australia. So there's a lot of those people and their descendants around. So it's amazing the connections that keep coming back to this sort of Shanghai community pre-war.
I know I've asked you this question before when we've had you on the program, and that is, when you're writing a story like this, when you're writing historical novel, do you know the story full out beforehand, before you start to write, or do you learn about the characters as you go along?
Yeah, absolutely. I learn them as I go along, and there's so many surprises. You know, there's so many of my favorite characters in this novel weren't in the outline. They came in the writing. You know, I have an avant-garde gay German artist who's a good friend and helps protect this family a little bit in Austria, and he shows up in Shanghai and has his own story arc and storyline, and that was fascinating, sort of. And I really grew to love that character. There's a local Chinese family that escaped Nanking and lost their mother and their sister to the massacre in Nanking. And you know, they're become integral in the story. So to me, that's the most fun part, when these characters just pop out of nowhere and become part of the story.
Having interviewed you several times and also having read all of your books, including the last one, Of Flesh and Blood, I get to know you a little bit, and I also got a bit of a feeling that you were in the last book.
Which character?
Would you say there's some of you in this new one, The Far Side of the Sky?
I think so. I think it's inevitable to a degree that you're in every book, any novel you write. But, you know, for me, the most identifiable character, the hero, is this stoic secular surgeon who shows up there. He reminds me a lot of my father. My father was a surgeon. He was only a teenager during the war, but he had to survive in Hungary on his wits. He was Jewish and managed to avoid roundups. And he has some unbelievably harrowing brushes with death. And my dad passed away last summer, but just a few months before, he had read the manuscript, and he was not a huge fan of my writing before then, but he really loved this book, and I'm really proud of that. And I think I see a lot of my dad in the hero in this book.
What was it like when you said your dad was not a fan of your previous writing?
Well, I shouldn't say, I exaggerate. He was more critical. I mean, he liked the books, but he always found a criticism, you know, and this book really resonated with him. He was really excited when he finished. But being my dad, he could never be just pure complimentary. So he goes, because I love this book, but he goes, I'm not sure any non-Jewish, non-doctors will like this book. So.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you are a doctor, your father is a doctor, and all your books have a medical angle to them. Is that something, I mean, you've departed from the type of thing you've written in the first five books. Would you ever see yourself walking away from the medical field as a writer?
Possibly. I mean, I like the idea of the challenge, but it's also fun, you know, with these, as you saw in Flesh and Blood, and now in this book, I get to explore the history of medicine a bit. I mean, there's some very pivotal medical scenes that I have to research what happened in 1938 and how different it would be from today. And that's really fun. I mean, I learn a lot, but also I can bring my medical perspective to that. And I wouldn't necessarily want to give that up.
Well, I look forward to reading this latest one. This new book is called The Far Side of the Sky. It's written by Daniel Kalla, Dr. Daniel Kalla. And Dan, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us once again.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Peter.
Dr. Dan Calla, author of The Far Side of the Sky. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0111, and you'll find links to Dan's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. In the interest of time, kindly hold your applause until the entire program is over.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of First Love, Last Dance. Plus, we'll meet the executive producer of King's Faith. And of course, there's an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on the show. But first, more Stuff File news right here, right now. You know, some fathers just don't seem to get it. In Orange Park, Florida, Dad Michael Turner allegedly became upset with his 17-year-old son for taking his sister to get a tattoo. Now, according to the police report, to express his displeasure with his son, Turner got into his car, revved up the engine, and drove straight at the boy twice. Lucky lad was able to dodge the vehicle both times. The son then struck his dad in self-defense with his fist through an open window in the vehicle. Dad responded by getting out of the vehicle, retrieving a crowbar from the trunk, and swinging it at his son. Mom managed to separate the two before deputies arrived. Turner was arrested and charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon without intent to kill. And the weirdest part is Turner sports quite a few tattoos of his own. There's a panther on his left leg, an eagle on his right leg, and a panther head on his right shoulder. Guess it's the classic do as I say, not as I do parenting technique that once again failed. Anyway, from time to time, we bring you stories of people misusing the 911 emergency system, but this may be the ultimate time when not to call 911. That would be while police are pursuing you in the middle of a high-speed chase. Now, this all began when police in Park City, Utah, tried to pull over a 20-year-old driver for speeding. But the driver, who had been going 15 miles per hour over the speed limit, wouldn't stop, and soon a 30-mile high-speed chase ensued. Now, while all this was going on, the driver called 911 to tell the officers chasing him that they need to leave him alone. The driver's father also called dispatchers during the chase and told them his son also called him and told him what was happening. The father said he told his son to stop, but he wouldn't listen. This all came to an end after deputies laid down some tire spikes. Now, our young friend stopped his car just short of the spikes and was taken into custody. So what caused all the chaos? It was a woman. The man's family told deputies he was having problems with his girlfriend shortly before the pursuit and was upset. Chief Deputy Sheriff Rigby said he had a bad morning and wasn't stopping for the cops. It was nothing more than that. Oh, the things we do because of the opposite sex. Yes. In Mexico, a priest turned a gun on his own congregation during the middle of Mass. Fortunately, it was just a water gun, loaded with holy water. Father Juan Ramon Hernandez said he did it after becoming saddened by the numerous drug-related killings and violence in his country. He told his congregation, "Let's pray to change the heart of the people who use violence and kill other people. Let's throw all the guns far away." The crowd seemed to enjoy it, as most smiled and giggled as the priest sprayed the first few rows with holy water. That's just what we need, drive-by baptisms. In Attleboro, Massachusetts, 65-year-old Robert E. Bailey made quite a scene when he stripped down to his birthday suit and proceeded to scrub his pickup truck at a public car wash. A woman vacuuming her vehicle at the car wash was the first to get an eyeful, and she immediately called police. By the time police arrived, Bailey was wearing shorts and denied he was ever naked. Enough witnesses contradicted his statement that a judge sentenced him to a 1-year probation and ordered him to stay away from the car wash and witnesses, and he'll also have to register as a sex offender. Okay, let's get something straight here. Washing your car naked at a public car wash probably makes you a freak, but does it really make you a sex offender? I mean, don't you have to do something sexual to be labeled a sex offender? Unless you consider polishing the hubcaps to be a euphemism for something else, washing a car just doesn't seem to cut it. I don't get it. But anyway, that's what the judge said. Kind of puritanical. Anyway, one more Stuff File news story before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program. If you find yourself desperate for funds to pay for your wedding that is just days away, copper wire is not the way to go. Just ask 23-year-old Joseph Russell and 24-year-old April Cater of Elwood City, Pennsylvania. The young lovers were to be married in just 4 days, but so desperate to pay for it all, they stole copper wire from more than a dozen utility poles, hoping to raise some cash. Problem was, aside from breaking the law and getting arrested, the stolen wire only netted them $18. Russell says he was desperate for money because he had just lost his job and lost a $1,000 deposit after the reception hall they had booked abruptly closed down. Sergeant Jeff Besky says the couple clearly expected to get more money than they got for the scrap where they sold the copper. This marriage is not going to be successful, I don't think. That's just my assumption there. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Nancy Rossman is a successful self-published author. Her book is entitled First Love, Last Dance. It's the true story of a woman who fell in love for the first time at age 19, got engaged at 21, but didn't marry the man until she was 75. What's almost as remarkable as the story in the book is the story of getting the book published. Nancy's on the line with us right now. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, as I mentioned, this is a true story. It's a remarkable story of this woman. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, my mother is a Southern girl raised in Atlanta, Georgia, and she met Peter in 1938 when they were both in freshman year in college. And fell in love. My mother said, really, he was her first true love. And they dated for a couple of years and then got engaged. But unfortunately, this young man did not do so well with my grandmother, my mother's mother. He did not impress her. And in fact, she took an instant distance to him when she first met him. And I think because, you know, thinking back to Southern culture in the 40s, in the late 30s and early 40s. It was very staid and conservative. My grandmother was a Presbyterian and believed that dancing was sinful. So, you know, it's hard to think in today's world this would have been an objection. And Peter was very affectionate with my mother. He liked to hold her hand and, you know, give her a hug sometimes. And my grandmother, she didn't go for that either. So she was smart enough, I think, to not prohibit her daughter from seeing him. But once my mother became engaged to him, then my grandmother really ramped up, and she was very vocal about how she didn't like this man and she didn't think he was the right one for my mother.
Okay, so obviously the two of them go their separate ways, have their own lives, because you're
That's
here,
right.
you're here. So obviously your mom got married and had children. But how did the two of them get back together?
Very good question. Well, they both maintained the same circle of friends in Atlanta. And when my mother broke up with Peter and ended up marrying my father, who just happened to be a Yankee and a Navy pilot during World War II, she ended up living in Ohio. But Peter and my mother both had contact with these same friends who would keep each of them informed about the other. And also, starting about the time when I was 8 years old, Peter would phone my mother at our home in Ohio every year on her birthday just to say hello and to wish her a happy birthday. And I know this is hard to imagine, but my father wasn't jealous, and in fact, he would tease my mother with things like, oh, it's 6 o'clock, I don't think Peter's going to call this year, and very jokingly, and then the phone would ring, and my mother would talk to him very briefly. And those phone calls actually continued until her 40th birthday, and then they quit.
Now, obviously, your mother got married. Did Peter get married?
Peter got married also, and he had the child who, he only had one child who was killed in an automobile accident when she was a teenager. My mother, when she married my father, living in Ohio, she had three children. So I'm the eldest of three siblings.
So let's flash forward to, she's 75 years old, and they get married?
Right. And they got married.
They got married. So what led to them getting together again?
Okay. Well, Peter's wife died, and he was married to his wife something like 48 years. My mother actually outlived my dad, who died young, and then she married a second gentleman who also died. So at the point in time when they got back together, they were both available, if you will. And my mother actually called Peter first to offer condolences about losing his wife. And then shortly thereafter, when she had called him, she lost her second husband. And so then, you know, all bets are off and they're free to get back to see each other, and that's exactly what happened.
So, flash forward, I mean, your mother, has been together with Peter, I believe, now for 15 years?
That's right, yeah, uh-huh.
That's amazing. Now, they must at some point talk about what your grandmother would think of all this if she were around.
Well, you know, I think that she would have had a change of heart. I think the things that she objected to about Peter were very surface and very much just cultural things. You know, as I said, the public display of affection and his attention to her, those were the things. And he had a car. He had his own car. He had worked a couple of jobs, and he had a little Ford, a little red car. And that was very unusual, too. So she was afraid for my mother driving around with Peter in that car.
I gotcha.
But I think she would have seen, you know, this was really a good man also. And my mother was very lucky to really have such great love with two different men.
So flash forward, everyone says that everybody's life is certainly a book worthy, and this one certainly is. But once you decided to turn this into a book, there was another battle to be won, and that was getting it published.
Yes, I tried really hard. It took me 5 years to write the book, and there was a lot of interest from various agents in New York. And so I thought, because I really put the time in and I had a really good editor, a professional editor of name that helped me with the rewrite, which was about a 10-month process. So the manuscript was in good shape. And I approached 82 different agents, as it turned out. I didn't pick 82 as being some magic number. It's just that's how many I ended up as my hit list. And six of them asked to read the entire manuscript. And in the end, they all came back with almost the same reason for rejection, which was, interesting story, well written. However, you're not famous. Your mother's not famous. There's no illicit sex. There's no controversial subject matter, and it has a happy ending. Nobody will buy it. So I self-published it. I set up my website. I self-published it. I approached NBC 2 months after the book came out, NBC here in Atlanta, where my mother and Peter live, and I pitched it to them as this would be a great Valentine's Day special. And they liked it. And from that point on, everything changed because several NBC affiliate stations in other cities, as well as CNN, picked it up and ran it. And so then I really had something I could sell to newspapers, to book publications as, you know, as an article, to do readings. I've done 100 readings in a year and a half in six different states. So it's been a tremendous amount of work and organization. But it's worked. That's what you need to do.
And we should mention the website is firstlovelastdance.com, which is, again, the title of the book. Such a story like this, even though it was rejected by so many different people as far as getting it published was concerned, such a story like this is the kind of story that people really seem to enjoy and would also make an interesting film. Now that the book is out, has there been any attention drawn to the idea of perhaps putting this on either the big screen or the small screen?
Oh, yeah, you're exactly right. In fact, I was approached by a producer, well-known producer in Hollywood, after it appeared on CNN, and he asked for the book, and I sent it to him, and he got back to me, and he said he thought because the video that NBC did, when you see it on my website, it's very funny, and so he thought the book would be comedic in its tone, and it's really, there is certainly a lot of funny things, but it's a, you know, it's a saga, it's a family story with a love thread, and so he turned it down, but he did recommend another person that he thought would be interested, a woman that does a lot of work for made-for-television movies, true stories, and with a love theme. And I just finished with her, and she said that the marketplace right now is more interested in controversial or juicy subject matter, but that she felt at some point in the not-too-distant future the tide would turn and somebody would be interested. So she's kept everything on file, and I may have another chance.
Well, we wish you great success. I mean, it's a story with a happy ending, and I'm sure your story in putting this book together will be one with a happy ending. The book is called First Love, Last Dance, written by Nancy Rossman. And Nancy, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you so much, Peter. My best to you today.
Nancy Rossman, author of First Love, Last Dance. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0111, and you'll find links to Nancy's website, plus links to Amazon.com, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. We often talk about lawsuit abuse and how it makes life difficult for Americans working on Main Street. If this economy is ever going to rebound, Main Street is going to lead the way. My good friend John Ratzenberger has now developed a Main Street jobs plan along with the Center for America. It addresses a huge problem that Wall Street and Washington haven't fixed. The problem is a growing skills gap in our country. Even with unemployment in this recession at 9%, there are still hundreds of thousands of skilled jobs going unfilled. Sadly, there aren't enough skilled workers to fill them. Imagine what we could do if we took action in our own communities to jumpstart skills training. It's going to take a lot of cooperation, but it could take a big chunk out of unemployment and get America working again. Let's be fair. If we don't address this problem, America will face a shortfall of as many as 10 million skilled workers by the year 2020. So let's get started. Learn more at centerforamerica.org.
Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal health care, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet the executive producer of the film, King's Faith. Plus, of course, we do indeed have an idiot of the day. But first, more Stuff File news for you right here, right now. In China, 22-year-old Xiao Li thought it would be oh so cute to hide the $700 gold necklace he bought for his girlfriend in a cake. Li said, "I thought it would show how much I love her, and it would be a good joke too." But then he watched in horror as 22-year-old Wang Xiu swallowed the jewelry he had baked inside the cake for her birthday party. After x-raying the girl, surgeons decided to operate to remove the necklace. She underwent endoscopic surgery where a probe was put down her throat and into her stomach to fish out the necklace. Li said she got her necklace back eventually, but I'm not so sure she will ever feel comfortable wearing it, even though I spent hours cleaning it for her. Yeah, I'm sure she's picking at her food more and more these days. Elsewhere, apparently our friends at Starbucks have forgotten that the economy sucks and nobody has any money these days. To celebrate 40 years of overcharging us for coffee, Starbucks has teamed up with designer Alexander Wang, who developed a white t-shirt that looks like you spilled coffee all over it. Leaving aside the question of whether or not that's the fashion statement you really want to make, they're selling the things for $85 each. The shirts are available at Nordstrom's or Starbucks, obviously, where you can get a real cup of coffee to spill on your shirt for only an extra $5. Anyway, the medical establishment generally regards placentas, that being afterbirth, as biohazardous waste. But to New York City placenta chef Jennifer Mayer, yeah, I said placenta chef, they are a nutrient-laden meat that can alleviate postpartum depression and aid in breast milk production, among other so far unverified benefits. Mayer typically sets up in clients' own kitchens. Some placentas are really intense with grief or sadness or uncertainty. Others might be joyful, big, and round. Mayer's method: drain the blood, blot dry, cook for a half hour, leaving something resembling brisket, chop into slivers, dehydrate overnight, rendering it jerky-like. And for a popular touch, Mayer also then grinds it in a blender and pours the powder into several dozen one-a-day capsules. Bet that's one thing nobody says tastes like chicken, huh? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, we have now for you a couple of stories in our latest installment of The Redneck Chronicles. Lon Groves, age 40, was arrested in Fort Walton Beach, Florida, after a brief standoff with police in July following an incident in which he allegedly held a handgun to the head of his wife in an argument over which of their granddaughters was the wife's favorite. And Pastor Daryl Riley of the New Welcome Baptist Church in St. Elmo, Alabama, was tased, allegedly by the church's music minister, whom Riley had just fired in August, which led another parishioner to pull a knife and begin stabbing wildly in the melee. Said the music minister's mother, "He done cut me before anything started." Yep, these people make the Clampets look like Rhodes Scholars, don't they? Yes. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Steve Bartolotta is one of the executive producers of the film King's Faith. It's a faith-driven story for teens starring Lynn Whitfield, James McDaniel, and Crawford Wilson. Steve is on the line with us right now to talk about the feature. Hi, Steve.
How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Good. Thanks for having me, Peter.
The story. Tell us what it's about.
Well, the story is of a kid. When we meet Brandon in this film, he's just gotten out of jail. So he's a kid that got into trouble as a young adult, 15 years old. He goes to jail. He's in a gang, and he gets out. And the only book that they really give him to read in jail is the Bible. So he reads the Bible, and he sorts of decides he wants to turn his life around. And comes out with that full intention, and we see what happens to him. He some of his old gang starts coming around, and there's some points of epiphany in his life to decide whether or not he's going to continue with his faith and how he's going to carry out that faith. So it's a compelling story. It's something that I think teens can relate to, whatever the trouble is in their lives, you know.
What led you to the film as a producer?
Well, it's an interesting story. My path to the film is that I've worked with a director, Nick DiBella, because I'm actually composing the music for the film. I've worked with him as a composer in the past, and I'm associated with Market Hole Productions, which is a marketing company, and the film initially needed some marketing help, so that was my role in it, and that's how I got into it from a production standpoint as well. So.
As I mentioned in the introduction, it is a faith-driven story, and sometimes, faith-driven films don't necessarily attract the attention, and let's be honest, sometimes the respect from some of the film community.
Yeah, that's a great point. Although I do think that's changing. I mean, if you look at the new movie that's coming out, Courageous, and also Soul Surfer is another one that have sort of crossed over, and. And honestly, I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, parents wanting to be able to go to a film that they can take their kids to and not feel uncomfortable. I mean, if you look at what's available for parents to take their teens to, there's either, you know, things that are just inappropriate for a family to be watching together, or, you know, in the case of younger teens, things that just are not interesting to the parents. So this is it has a story. It's a compelling film, but you're not going to find anything in it that's going to make you squirm in your seat while you're sitting next to your teenage son or daughter.
By the same token, there is a difference between films that are rated, for instance, let's say G, that don't have gratuitous sex or violence, and one that has a faith-driven story.
I agree with you on that. There's no question about it. The rating of the film, it'll probably be in a G rating situation, but, you know, I'm hoping that people have the foresight to give the movie a chance and look at it for the content that's in it. So,
who do you see your primary audience for this film being?
I see it as teens. I see it as young adults, I should say, that... are looking for something outside of, you know, what they're being offered right now. We're seeing it in terms of the popularity. I think obviously the secondary market are their parents as well. So if you look at the people that are interested in this film, if you were to look at our social media, for example, I mean, there's a lot of interest among younger younger teens and young adults.
Do you feel that it's a market that is being underserved right now?
I think it's a market that's emerging, but I definitely feel like it's underserved at this point. But I think that's going to change because if when something becomes popular, then obviously the people migrate towards it, and that's what's starting to happen. Facing the Giants was another film that came out a couple of years ago that did extremely well, crossed over. The other film that we were looking at in our sort of evaluation was a film called To Save a Life, which is, again, another faith-based film. But these films are, they have good directors. They have, marquee actors in them, and the stories are good. So, those are the components of a successful film.
Well, you mentioned marquee actors, Lynn Whitfield and James McDaniels, very talented actors indeed. How did you get them attached to the project?
Well, obviously the script determines who you want to try and cast. We had an excellent casting director that worked on this. The director, Nick DiBella, had a real vision of what these characters were like. And we sent it out to a few, just a very few people, and among them were James and Lynn, and they both embraced the project because I think it's an opportunity to do something that's a little bit outside of what they've done recently, and the script and the story are quite compelling.
What is the release date for the film?
Well, that's a great question. We don't have a specific release date. I'm sure you can realize that these films get edited and re-edited, and obviously the music has to be done still. And then we'll probably release it to a few festivals first to get some opinions on it. But the tentative date is summer of 2012. So
we're a little ways away, but not too far.
Yeah, no. Yeah, we're working on a rough cut of the film right now, and that should be ready in the next, say, 60 days. But that'll get refined over and over again over the next 6 months after that.
One of the things a lot of films go through today, either rightly or wrongly, is focus groups.
Uh-huh.
Are you prepared for focus groups and the reaction of a so-called test audience?
We absolutely are. We plan on having some focus groups in the spring to air this when it gets a little bit closer to the version that we're close to, and the audience is the audience. So what we're thinking when we're making a film isn't necessarily always the way people react to it, and that's certainly something that we want to take into consideration. So,
in the greater film world, the name of the film is King's Faith. I've also introduced it as a faith-driven story. Do you find sometimes just that concept, a faith-driven story, sometimes scares some people away?
I do. I obviously that's a stigma that it is changing, but that's something that people contemplate. They say, "Well, is this for me?" And I can tell you from viewing the footage that we have and reading the script, obviously a number of times, this movie is for everybody. Whether you are a person of faith, or you're just someone that is interested in a compelling story. You walk out of this film moved by it, and contemplative over the story itself, and that's what people want in entertainment.
So it's something we can look forward to probably, as you say, in the spring of 2012. Correct?
Spring or early summer.
Spring or early summer. The film is called King's Faith, and Steve, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
My pleasure, Peter. I really appreciate your time as well.
Steve Bartolotta is one of the executive producers of the film King's Faith. You can check out the website for the movie at kingsfaith.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0111, and you'll find links to the film's website. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Now, for aspiring bank robbers, we imagine there's a certain unspoken checklist of things you should and shouldn't do. For 29-year-old New Jersey resident Chris Burnett, We think he might have got the words shouldn't and should confused. On Monday morning, he pushed his way to the front of the line at the Manhattan Bank and handed a note to the teller saying he had a gun and wanted some cash. On paper, it sounds like a good start. On the security camera, not so much. Burnett had failed to wear any disguise but wore gloves. That morning, he made off with $2,258. The next morning, rather than spending his money on a trip to Mexico and a new look, Burnett decided to head back to the same bank for more. This time, he made around $14,000. The bank noticed they had a fan and sent security camera images of Burnett to the police and local newspapers. The next day, with all the staff and local authorities familiar with his face, he returned to rob the bank again. This time he made off with $10,002, but didn't get very far before he was caught. Oh, at least he still wore those gloves. Why would anyone rob the same bank three times in a row and without the benefit of disguise? Oh, some might say he's just lazy, but I debate that by simply saying, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0111. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And by going to the website, you can find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And again, that's 0111. The email address is peter@thestufffile.com. That's where you'll find me. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes.
Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.